Right, today we're joined by Rafael Mangual. He is the Nick O'Neill Fellow at the Manhattan Institute in New York City and the author of a very exciting new book, Criminal Injustice: What the Push for Decarceration and Depolicing Gets Wrong and Who It Hurts Most, published by Center Street and available in fine bookstores everywhere. Rafael, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Jamil. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Now, your book focuses on the criminal justice system in the United States, which, of course, there are some very key differences between U.S. law and policy and Canadian law and policy. But I think every Canadian listening, and for the Americans listening, they'll, I think, appreciate this too, that what's happening in the U.S. when it comes to criminal justice has a big impact on other countries, particularly Canada, because of our proximity. Sometimes it feels like what's making the news when it comes to the justice system in the US is might as well be happening in Toronto or Vancouver, the way Canadians react. So I think your book has some really important value to Canadians in particular, because the better we understand what's happening in the US, the better prepared and equipped we are to process the news stories as they come to our side of the border. So the first question I want to ask you, which I assume is something that you spend a lot of time talking, thinking, and certainly writing about, is whether the American criminal justice system should be considered racist or not.
I don't think it should be. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And I'm glad that we're starting here, because I do think that that question is really at the root of a lot of what I consider to be the most misguided policy initiatives to address criminal justice policy in the United States. And I expect they're also at the root of a lot of criminal justice reform efforts north of our border in Canada. And so there are a lot of reasons. So, you know, one of the mainstays of the case for why the criminal justice system here in the US is racist has a lot to do with the hyper-focus on disparities in enforcement measures. So we see a lot of racial disparities with respect to arrests, incarcerations, prosecutions, along racial lines, and those kinds of get seized upon to make the case that the criminal justice system is racist. One of the problems with this is that that framing uses the sort of proportion that supposedly disfavored groups, particularly Blacks and Latinos here, they're focusing on the proportion that those groups constitute of the general population. They're not controlling for other race-neutral relevant factors that might actually go a long way toward explaining why those disparities exist. Things like involvement in crime, both as perpetrators and victims, right? Like, one of the things people fail to appreciate here in the United States, but also around the world, is that crime is hyper-concentrated, particularly with respect to cities. So generally speaking, there's something called the rule of crime concentration, wherein you'll find that in most cities across the world, about 5% of street segments are going to see 50% of all crime. We also know that there's a huge disparity, at least here in the United States, with respect to victimization along demographic lines. So, for example, in my home city of New York, a minimum of 95% of all shooting victims every single year are either Black or Hispanic. Almost all of them are male. Right? If you look at the city of Chicago, take the 10 most dangerous neighborhoods in that city, they're about 95%+ Black, and they have a homicide rate that is in excess of 60 per 100,000. And to just contextualize that, that's using 2019 data, to contextualize that, the national homicide rate here that year was 5 per 100,000. And so once you start to take account for the geographic and demographic concentration of crime and criminal victimization, you start to see why, for example, police resources are going to be disproportionately deployed to the areas that are suffering the largest crime problems. Well, that in and of itself is going to be enough to produce disparities along enforcement measures, because in fact, police are spending a disproportionate amount of their time where most of the crime is. And if a certain demographic group is overrepresented in those areas, well, then police are going to have disproportionate numbers of contacts with people in those areas and of those demographic groups. And so what you find in the literature is once you actually start controlling for crime patterns, for the geographic concentration of crime, once you start controlling for criminal history as a factor in sentencing, for example, the disparities that so often get seized on as evidence, as prima facie evidence of racism, start to disappear. They don't necessarily go away entirely, but what's left as an unexplained disparity is so small that it's not at all obvious that that disparity is a function of racism. Like with respect to sentencing, I think what you'd find is once you control for all relevant race-neutral factors, you're talking about sentencing disparities that are on the order of weeks. That would be a very strange way for, I think, racism to sort of manifest itself in that decision-making process. To say like, a 3 weeks additional sentence is satisfying the racial animus of some judge who's probably not even aware of what the broader data says. There's also a big problem with this argument insofar as it ignores a proper historical analysis of crime policymaking in the United States. There's a lot of focus, for example, on like the drug war here in the U.S., looking at things like the Rockefeller drug laws in New York City, which were the mandatory minimums for crack cocaine. And then the follow-on to that at the federal level here in the form of the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, which was signed by President Reagan and established the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine. Now, people see this and they say, well, look, crack was so much more prominent in low-income Black communities across the United States. Why are they punishing it so much more harshly than powder cocaine, especially given the fact that cocaine use is just as prevalent in white communities as in Black communities? And what I think people fail to recognize is that there was a lot of violence associated with the crack trade here in the U.S. that wasn't associated with the powder cocaine trade in the same way. And so if you look at the history of the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, what you'll see is that 16 of the 19 members of the Congressional Black Caucus here co-sponsored, not just voted for, but co-sponsored that legislation. And there's a really great book by a scholar named Michael Fortner called Black Silent Majority that actually looked at the role of Black Americans in New York in the development of the Rockefeller drug laws, in which you would have found in the 1970s and 80s and 90s was a lot of support for harsh treatment of the crack cocaine trade. You could actually go back to 1990 and watch white founder of National Review, William F. Buckley, debating drug legalization with Black congressman from East Harlem, Charlie Rangel. And Charlie Rangel actually proposed his life in prison for certain crack dealers, while William F. Buckley at the time is arguing in favor of broad scale legalization. So I think the racism argument also ignores the historical account. But most importantly, in addition to a lot of other reasons, I think the biggest flaw in this argument has a lot to do with the fact that there's another side to the ledger, right? Enforcement outcomes are not the only outputs of the criminal justice system. When the criminal justice system operates according to its stated ends, as stated by the people at the system's helm, what it produces are crime declines. And the benefits associated with those crime declines inure primarily to Black and brown communities here in the U.S. So if you look at the homicide decline between 1990 and 2014, one, I think there's a really strong case to be made that the bulk of that decline was a function of policing and incarceration policy. But that added a full year of life expectancy to the average Black man in America. It only added 0.14 years of life expectancy to the average white man in America. And so I think people have to really grapple with that question. Why is it that a system supposedly designed and operated to the detriment of the Black community so disproportionately benefits the Black community when it does the things that the people at the system's helm say they are trying to do through that system? When crime goes down, it doesn't really benefit people living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan or, the posh neighborhoods in Brooklyn where, a brownstone costs $5 million. It benefits people who are living in places like West Garfield Park, Chicago, where the homicide rate is 131 per 100,000, which is unimaginable for most people to understand what that would look like. And so, what I try to do with the book is kind of give people a sense of what this reality is in light of what the data say. And I think that pokes a really giant hole in what has become the dominant narrative here in the United States and in other parts of the world about, what criminal justice actually looks like for, minority communities.
So you said a lot there, and I want to pick up on a couple things. So the first thing I want to ask you about is where you see the role of guns and gun control in explaining the high proportion of violence in the U.S. compared to other countries. So let me just give you an example. So you mentioned Chicago. In 2021, Chicago had 797 homicides, most of which came from gun violence. Toronto, my hometown, is the same population size as Chicago. We had 117 homicides. That's a huge difference. In fact, the entire country of Canada had less homicides than Chicago did, one American city. Canada had 788. So I think a lot of Canadians would look at numbers like that or news headlines about violence in American cities and conclude, well, what's the difference between our two countries? Why is it that Chicago has so many more murders than our biggest city? And I think people would conclude that gun culture would be one major difference in the United States compared to Canada. So what do you say to people who would take, you know, would agree with everything you've said and then conclude that's why we need more gun control?
Well, one, I think there are a lot of questions that have yet to be answered about the efficacy of a lot of popular gun control measures. I mean, these things have been studied for many, many decades on end, and there is not a consistent direction in the literature to support the idea that popular gun control measures like licensing requirements, like bans, like age restrictions, ammo restrictions, et cetera, are actually effective ways of reducing serious gun violence. So that's point one. Point two is that there actually doesn't seem to be a pretty consistent relationship in the United States between the availability of guns and gun violence. I know that sounds counterintuitive to a lot of people, but if you look at, you know, from the 20th century up through modern times, what you'd find is a pretty consistent uptick in the number of guns in private circulation, but you would not see a similar tracking of the homicide data that follows that trend in any kind of clear way. And, you know, I think one of the just sort of most prominent examples of that is the crime decline of the 1990s. I mean, this happened during a period in which gun rights in the United States were expanded. It happened in a period in which the availability of guns was expanded, the number of guns in circulation increased dramatically. And yet, you know, in my home city of New York, we went from 2,262 murders in 1990 to 292 murders in 2017. What that tells me is that I think guns are not the proximate cause of the sort of violence that we see here. What I think we have is a higher concentration of very chronic, very violent offenders that we can actually do a significantly better job of incapacitating by concentrating on them. I mean, you know, I made the point earlier about how concentrated crime is geographically, but crime perpetration is even more concentrated. I mean, there are studies showing that, you know, in certain populations that somewhere in the range of 1% of people will account for about 65% of all violent crime. There are analyses in American cities where you're talking about anywhere from a few hundred to a little over 1,000 individuals that are responsible for the bulk of the city's gun violence. In Oakland, I think it was like 0.1% of the population was responsible for the majority of homicides. So what that tells me is that our resources are much better focused on trying to concentrate law enforcement expenditures and resources on the population of people that pose the highest risks of being involved in gun violence. And we can actually do a pretty decent job of identifying who those people are through the use of big data, looking at factors like gang membership, like prior arrest histories, like social network analyses to determine, you know, how many degrees removed is an individual from somebody who has a homicide case or who's been a suspect in a shooting, et cetera. And so all that to say is that I think criminal control is actually much more effective as a method of crime reduction than gun control is ever going to be, particularly because the cat is already out of the proverbial bag here in the United States. I mean, we have somewhere in the range of 500 million guns already in private circulation. The idea that we can control that number of anything, particularly at a time in which the technology has evolved to the point where, you know, making a ghost gun in your living room is actually pretty easy to do. I think we have to be realistic about focusing on what's going to be the highest leverage use of our resources.
Now, Raphael, you mentioned the small percentage of people who account for the majority of violent crime in a given city. And that's certainly true in Canadian cities, American cities, cities all over the world probably have the exact same dynamic. I often bring that up when I feel that activists or, you know, people who are on the sort of political left and might insinuate that crime is the result of purely environmental circumstances are sort of engaging in a different type of stereotype, because I think most kids who grow up in poverty in the inner city, most kids who grow up in public housing, most kids who struggle in a single parent household, they don't hurt anyone. They follow the laws. They don't break a single rule. They're as law abiding as anyone else. It's actually a very small number of people in some of those circumstances who resort to violence. And I'm wondering what you can share with us about what you've learned about why this small percentage of people gets involved in violence in the first place. Some people might say, for instance, that it's belonging to certain subcultures, and that's where, you know, the hip hop industry, for example, might be criticized. So I'm just curious how you would explain that 0.1% in Oakland, for example, or that small fraction of people in Chicago responsible for so much chaos and suffering, what it is about that particular group that makes them susceptible to violent crime that the majority of people in the same neighborhoods do not engage in.
I think you're exactly right to point this out. I mean, the concentration of crime is incongruous with what are so often pointed to as the root causes of violence, right? Lots of people focus on socioeconomic indicators as being at the root of violence. And they do that because they support social spending as the primary mechanism through which we should seek to reduce violence. And I don't think that's a very viable strategy, in part because, you know, there's incongruity between that theory and what the data say. For example, you know, in New York, again, 1990, we saw 2,262 murders. And in 2017, we saw just 292. Well, we can actually compare the city's poverty rates in 2016, the year before we hit our valley, and in 1989, the year before we peaked. And what you find is that the poverty rate in 1989 was actually slightly lower than it was in 2016. So, you know, poverty essentially remains unchanged, in fact, moves slightly in the wrong direction. And yet we have this, you know, 90%+ decline in homicides. And what that tells you is exactly what I think you're pointing at. So if we're trying to answer the question, though, what makes this tiny percentage of people that drive the bulk of violence so disposed to that violence, I mean, my best guess, based on, you know, my reading of the literature, is that family breakdown has a decent amount to do with it. And, you know, you find a lot of sort of correlation between single parenthood and involvement in violence among young boys. I think one of the reasons for that is because, you know, a two-parent household, particularly a married two-parent household, is going to have more success with the socialization process. And the socialization process, I think, is really important, because what you find is that more common among serious criminal offenders than poverty is actually psychological dispositions of antisocial personalities. So if you look at something like antisocial personality disorder, that diagnosis has a prevalence rate in the United States between 1% and 3% in the general population. For men, it's between 2% and 4%. But in prison settings, it can range from anywhere from 40% to 70%, depending on the facility. So, you know, that I think tells you something. And if you look at, you know, what some of the literature says on the intergenerational transmission of antisocial behavior, what you'll find is that exposure to antisocial parents is actually a pretty significant indicator of whether or not a child is going to develop the sort of conduct disorder that is associated with involvement in violent crime in later life. And so I do think family structure has a lot to do with it, at least at the front end, in terms of creating the conditions and the form of those conduct disorders that have the potential to metastasize in ways that become involved with more serious violent crime. And then I think you have, in a lot of high crime communities, this sort of subculture that elevates violence as both a legitimate means of respect acquisition, as well as a legitimate means of dispute resolution. And so this is something that I saw growing up, you know, hanging out in, you know, neighborhoods that certainly were not the safest. You know, there was an expectation that as a male, part of what made you belong to that community was going to be your willingness to fight. And if you ever got punked in, you know, a public space in a public way, that, you know, kind of led to your social ostracization. And so I think hip hop, you know, certainly plays a role in this, at least in describing this phenomenon for people who, you know, for the uninitiated who might not be so familiar with it. But I do think that, you know, there's something to that subculture argument, in part because, you know, there's this thing called crime adversity mismatch that a criminologist named Barry Latzer came up with a few years ago. And basically what he finds is that you can actually find various culturally identifiable groups that have lots of the same indicators with respect to things like poverty measures, unemployment measures, household income measures. And they're just as poor, just as dispossessed as other groups, yet have very, very low involvement in violent crime, even lower than some higher income groups. Like you can take, you know, Asian Americans living in New York City, especially first generation Asian Americans and Asian immigrants in New York City, they have significantly lower crime rates than, say, Black Americans in New York City, despite suffering poverty at higher rates, despite having lower household incomes. You can look at just East Harlem, which is a neighborhood, you know, generally known for having higher levels of crime. And household income for Hispanic households in East Harlem is actually about $4,000 lower than it is for Black households in East Harlem. And yet Hispanic male involvement in violent crime, while higher than average, is certainly lower than Black male involvement. I think what that points to is a cultural explanation for crime. And, you know, I think that's something that people who pay attention can see, you know, if they look closely. It makes us uncomfortable. It makes a lot of people uncomfortable to talk about. But I do think it's something that we have to consider as a possibility. Because as you say, I mean, the vast majority of people who suffer the same kinds of economic conditions that we often see correlated with involvement in crime are actually quite law abiding. So that doesn't really serve as a really good explanation for why we see the disparities that we see.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept there, the crime adversity mismatch. I haven't heard that before. I'll definitely do some looking into it. The last question I have for you, Raphael, is just on the issue of bail. It's one of the things that you talk about in your work. It's one of the issues that I think is resonating across North America, even in Canada. It's one of the go-to policy areas for debate in terms of how we should treat people who have been incarcerated, especially if they've been connected to violent crime. What do you think smart bail reform looks like?
So smart bail reform on paper, and this is an important distinction, looks like a system in which the decision of whether to release somebody pre-trial while their charges are pending, and if so, under what conditions, is a function not of wealth, not of the amount of money that they have access to, but rather a function of the risks that they pose to the community. I think one of the sort of critiques that I'm actually very sympathetic to that are at the root of a lot of bail reform efforts across the world is the idea that people who have been charged and not yet convicted of a crime, you know, should not be held simply as a function of their inability to come up with a few hundred dollars or a few thousand dollars, whatever it is. You know, there's this situation in which a heavy reliance on cash bail can lead to a dangerous but well-off defendant buying his or her pretrial freedom, while an indigent but relatively harmless defendant gets stuck behind bars for the pretrial period. So I think smart bail reform reorients that inquiry around risk as opposed to wealth. That I think is both more efficient as a means of providing for the public safety, but also more equitable insofar as I don't think it's fair for people to be held at pretrial simply because they can't come up with a certain amount of money that's kind of arbitrarily defined according to some schedule. Now, I do think risk should drive the inquiry irrespective of the charges that people face. This is another really important point of contention. Lots of people say, well, hey, this individual is charged with a nonviolent crime, therefore they don't pose a risk to the community. That's not true. The instant offense that somebody is charged with is a terrible predictor of the overall risk that they pose to the community. What we find in New York City, for example, is that people who are facing felony charges actually reoffend during the pretrial period at a lower rate than people who are facing misdemeanor charges. And that makes sense once you look at it, because people who are antisocial in their dispositions, that antisocial disposition is going to manifest itself in a multitude of ways. You know, there's no such thing as a strictly violent criminal who says, like, oh, I only kill people and hurt people. I don't litter and I don't do drugs and I don't, you know, violate other social norms. That just doesn't exist. And so, you know, I think that's what a smart bail reform looks like. I also think a smart bail reform should be coupled with a funding of the system that allows us to dispose of criminal cases in a much quicker manner than we are currently doing here in the United States. I mean, at the root of the bail reform critique, It's a function of how long people stand to spend in pretrial detention, which is understandable. It's crazy to me that in a country as rich as the U.S. and in a city as rich as New York, it can take 2 years to get your case from filing to disposition. That's insane. But what that tells you is that the criminal justice system is really underfunded. And I suspect that's true in other parts of the world. So I said on paper, because there are jurisdictions in the United States that have all of these things in place. But what we see is that, you know, laws are only as good as the humans administering them. And so you can have a jurisdiction with great pretrial release policy, but if they have a progressive prosecutor who is prohibiting his lying prosecutor from even requesting bail or pretrial detention in certain cases, if you have a judiciary that's not willing to pull the lever of remanding somebody to pretrial detention on the grounds that they are dangerous, well, then what you have on paper becomes irrelevant. Right. And so I think that's what we're actually seeing in a lot of places. Chicago is one of them, where in Chicago, judges can exercise discretion and hold somebody in pretrial detention on the basis of the risk that they pose. What we see is a large scale unwillingness to do that. And that has consequences. And, you know, the point that I wanted to make in this book, and why I started the book with a chapter that looks at crime concentration, is that those consequences are not going to be evenly distributed in any community ever. It's going to be the people who are the least fortunate, living in places that are already struggling with elevated levels of crime, that are already struggling with other social problems, that are going to bear the brunt of the risks associated with the kinds of programs that lower the transaction cost of committing crimes and raise the transaction cost of enforcing the law. And I do think that that's where the debate is headed across North America, that the critique is so hyper-focused on the inefficiencies and inequities involved in the criminal justice system that it is blinding activists to the good that the criminal justice system so often produces. It's not a one-way street. And if we throw the baby out with the bathwater, that is going to produce significant harms that are going to come in the form of the stories that I tell in the book of people who have had their lives taken, have had their flesh torn up, have had their families torn apart by individuals who had no business being out on the street. I mean, you know, I'm sure you see this, you know, in cities like Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver, as well as, you know, here and throughout the U.S., where you read a story of a heinous crime committed by somebody who has 15, 20, 30 prior arrests, who has multiple prior convictions, who was out on parole, who was out on probation, who was out on pretrial release. These are individuals who could have been but weren't incarcerated at the time. And, you know, for all the talk of our over-incarceration problem, we have ignored the fact that we also have an under-incarceration problem that might actually be bigger. And again, you know, it's very easy for people living in safe enclaves in posh neighborhoods to kind of write this risk off and say, like, no, we have to deal with the over-incarceration problem, because they don't ever have to see what the under-incarceration problem looks like. They're not living in the sorts of places where they're going to have to walk past a group of gangbangers, you know, to get to and from school. They're not living in places where they have to tell their kids, you have to come in before the streetlights turn on because it gets too dangerous. They're not living in places in which kids watch TV on the floor instead of on the couch because they don't want bullets that might come through the window to hit them. These are realities in far too many American neighborhoods, and I suspect far too many neighborhoods around the world. And I think that what you'll see if you examine this issue in Canada as well as in the United States is that at the root of serious violent crime are individuals who, contrary to the popular narrative, have not been denied second chances, but have been given, you know, second, third, and tenth chances. And then the question becomes, you know, how much risk should we be willing to impose on the people living in the communities that those individuals are going to find themselves living in if we don't take them off the street? And, you know, my answer to that has been that we're taking far too many risks with their lives now, and it's long past time that we do a better job of providing them public safety the best way that we know how, and that is to take dangerous people off the street when they have made very clear through their actions that they have no intention of playing by society's rules.
The book is Criminal Injustice: What the Push for Decarceration and Policing Gets Wrong and Who It Hurts Most. The author, Rafael Mangual, just incredible stuff. Really appreciate you joining us and sharing your insights. That book is published by Center Street. And if you're interested in more of Raphael's work, you can check him out over at the Manhattan Institute, where he is the Nick O'Neill Fellow and the head of research at the Policing and Public Safety Initiative. Rafael, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.